you very much.
Given the case is submitted, we'll hear arguments next in Federal Reserve System against Dimension Financial.
This is a sense right good stuff.
Mr. Banfield, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case involves the validity of Federal Reserve Board rules applying the Bank Holding Company Act to the corporate owners of certain banks, so-called non-bank banks. The Bank Holding Company Act applies to companies that control a bank, which the Act defines as any institution that both takes deposits, which the depositor has a legal right to withdraw on demand, and engages in the business of making commercial loans. The first part of this definition concerning demand deposit was added to the Act in 1966, substituting for a broad charter test. The second half was added in 1970. Bank holding companies may engage in only limited activities, owning banks, and in activities that are closely related to banking. The Act prohibits the commingling of banking and commerce. This policy was adopted to prevent abuses in the allocation of credit, to prevent concentration of banking resources in a few hands, and to maintain local control over local banking resources. These companies, securities firms, insurance firms, retail firms, and other commercial and industrial companies which control non-bank banks, claim that they have removed themselves from the regulation under the Act when they act through national banks, state banks, and industrial banks to provide essential banking services, but eschew either the taking of demand deposits or the making of commercial loans. Beginning in 1980, there was a sudden explosion in the number of institutions that use this device, but in a new way, to achieve interstate banking and to combine banking and commerce. The board became concerned that these institutions, which took NOW accounts and made commercial loans, would become a vehicle for preferential lending and for interstate banking in violation of state policy. In response, a unanimous board of governors, after rulemaking, defined the term deposits that the depositor has a legal right to withdraw on demand to include NOW accounts.
Mr. Bradfield, in 1966, when Congress was considering adopting the definition, did the board propose to Congress that in defining demand deposits that it include accounts which in actual practice were paid on demand? Was that a suggestion made by the board to Congress in 66?
That was a suggestion that was made by the board took the position, not in practice, but that accounts that were payable by check, the accounts that were payable on demand should be covered by the Act. There's a bit of history that I will get to, Justice O'Connor, concerning industrial banks and their proposal and the board's proposal to cover.
Yes, but my concern is to determine whether the essence of the present board rule and position was one that was suggested by the board itself to Congress in 1966 and resulted in the adoption of somewhat formalistic language by the Congress that rejected, in
essence, the board actually proposed the language was deposits payable on demand. That language later became deposits that the depositor has a legal right to payment on demand. I do not think that there was any significance to that change in language. The legislative history that Congress, the committee reports, specifically say that they were talking about demand deposits, checking accounts, and they use parenthesis right after demand deposits, they were using checking accounts. And I don't believe that they intended any specific technical distinction.
Well, are we safe in concluding that Congress did not intend to pick up passbook savings accounts
its definition? I believe that that is correct, and the legislative history makes that
clear. Tell me whether you think literally the board's new definition of a now account is broad enough to pick up passbook savings accounts.
The board's definition does not pick up savings account, doesn't apply to savings account, and the legislative history makes it clear that the Congress was not intending to cover savings.
Well, does the literal language of the board's new definition cover, is it broad enough to conceivably cover passbook savings accounts?
Technically, it's possible that it might cover that, but the specifics of the definition do not cover passbook savings accounts because they are not payable by check. They are not payable by third-party means of payment, and that's the essence of what Congress was trying to drive at, driving at those instruments that were money. Checks are money. When you go to the grocery store and you give the clerk a check, you are creating money at that point. And that's what Congress was concerned about, the combination of that characteristic with the combination of that characteristic with commercial lending. And when the two are combined, Congress was concerned that that created great power over resources, the potential for preferential lending, and the Congress wanted to prohibit that and wanted to prohibit the owners of banks from using those facilities for their own benefit.
Well, Mr. Bradfield, if you turn to page 2 of your petition for certiorari, you probably have this material at hand without turning to it. If you look at the statutory definition in 1841C, that a bank means any institution which accepts deposits that the depositor has a legal right to withdraw on demand. And then if you look right below that to the regulation comes along and says deposits that the depositor has a legal right to withdraw on demand means any deposit that as a matter of practice is payable on demand. Now, that doesn't strike me as being within what Congress was talking about. Congress says you have to have a legal right to withdraw on demand, and the board says, no, it's just a practical matter.
Because in practice... There are two aspects to that. One is that in practice, the notice, it's not practical to give the notice. The notice, this is an instrument that is passed into the hands of a third party. When passed into the third party and notice is given, then that check is in effect dishonored by the institution. And when dishonored by the institution, it completely impairs the ability of the institution to function as a financial institution.
Perhaps that's a sensible answer to my question, but I'd intended to get at another point. It seems to me when Congress has said that they're talking about deposits, that the depositor has a legal right to withdraw on demand. And then the board comes along and says this language that Congress means any deposit that as a matter of practice is payable on demand. It seems that that's a significant alteration of Congress's meaning. Congress was talking in pretty strict terms about the legal right to withdraw on demand.
First I would like to go back to the legislative history and point out that Congress was talking about, I don't think they were making that technical distinction. Congress was talking about what was a commercial bank, characterized a commercial bank. That's what they said in the legislative history. They were driving at what was a commercial bank. And this kind of instrument that creates money was one of the characteristics of a commercial bank that they were driving at. And they clearly didn't mean it. And when you look at the whole legislative history in perspective, they clearly didn't mean to turn on one technical aspect to be able to undermine the whole objectives of the Act.
Why then did they use the rather technical language, has a legal right to withdraw on demand?
Because they believed that that was the equivalent of the demand deposit language that was already in board regulations at that time.
But yet they didn't take the board regulations. They took this much stricter language.
But they explained that in the legislative history. I don't think there is any technical basis for concluding that they intended something different. They looked at the board regulation that was in effect since 1933. And what the board defined a demand deposit as any instrument that was subject to withdrawal by check. Any deposit that was subject to withdrawal by check was a checking account and was a demand deposit. And the purpose of that was to prevent evasions of the basic prohibition of payment of interest on demand deposits. And so that any instrument that was withdrawable by check was a demand deposit. That was what was in front of the Congress in 1966 when it adopted the language. Now, there was that shift. The board recommended demand deposit in its recommendation to the Congress. It was changed to deposit that the deposit has a legal right to withdraw on demand. But there's no basis for concluding that they meant in that technical distinction something far different. And I would add to that, strengthen that, by the very people who asked for this change. The very people who asked for this change were the industrial bankers. Now, they said, we do not offer checking accounts. We take certificates, savings certificates. And we don't make commercial loans. We make consumer loans. So we don't object to what the board has done, and the board had earlier defined them within the scope of the act. We don't object to what the board has done with respect to checking accounts. What we object to is what the board has done by saying that savings accounts that are in practice paid on demand are within the scope of the act. Now, that is what Congress overturned, and they overturned that in a very narrow way, intending to exempt industrial banks and savings banks that, as far as Congress was concerned, did not have any kind of a transactional account and did not make commercial loans. So they were completely outside the scope of what Congress was worried about.
But how does a NOW account really differ significantly from the kind of accounts you've just referred to?
A NOW account, yes, very significantly different because it has a transaction capability. What those accounts that I was talking about are really savings accounts in which you need a passbook, essentially a passbook. There's no third-party transaction capability. You need a passbook. You have to go to the institution and withdraw your money. Then is when you have money. In the case of a transaction account, when you go to the store or you make a purchase, then you have money when you actually write your check. And that's the thing that was the essence of banking that Congress was concerned about, and said those two characteristics, the ability to create instruments that are money and the ability to make commercial loans, those were the characteristics that we are worried about. And the legislative history is replete with references to that.
Mr. Bradfield, if your position, if the board's position with its new definition of NOW accounts is valid, do I understand that it would it would be required that some industrial loan companies go out and try to purchase FDIC insurance, which for other technical reasons they would not be able to do? Are we going to have a hiatus in the requirements?
Justice O'Connor, you make a very excellent point that has been strongly made on the side of the respondents, that the board's rule somehow upsets basic industry expectations. And I think I'd like to take a minute to refute that, because I think it's just simply not the case. First, in the case of industrial banks, we've made a careful survey and found only 53 industrial banks, 26 of which are in Colorado, which in fact offer NOW accounts and make commercial loans. So of the about 1,200 industrial banks in the country, only that less than 5% would be covered by the board's regulation. Of those companies, we don't know how many, but not all of those 53 are owned by companies, so that they might not have to register in any event.
Routine practice of allowing withdrawals on demand?
That's exactly what I was getting to, Your Honor.
Their
traditional function has been not to offer NOW accounts. In fact, as I described, their traditional activity has been to offer savings certificates and making consumer loans. And if they just simply
if they changed the practice, where would you be then? Would that you rest quite heavily on that?
Well, that is what Congress was concerned about. I rest very heavily on that because that's what Congress was concerned about. When they do often have accounts and they do make commercial
loans. Then it wouldn't be like an ordinary bank anymore.
So then it wouldn't be covered by the Bank Holding Company Act, and we wouldn't be worried. It's possible that we ought to be worried about it, and it would be up to Congress to change that. But that is not covered at this time in the board's regulations. We're worried about the combination of now accounts, money, and commercial loans, which these institutions, these 50-odd institutions, actually engage in now. There's another class of institutions, which is the privately insured SNLs, and that industry, which did very recently and very rapidly, like the industrial banks, those institutions have recently gone into now accounts and commercial loans. And as I think all of the court is aware, that industry has essentially been destroyed by the events in Ohio and Maryland. They were originally participants in this case and have withdrawn from this case and no longer oppose the board's rule. And the fact the very reason that a number of them got into trouble is because they weren't subject to regulation. Their owners were able to take advantage of the institutions, make preferential loans, take those now account and other deposits that they have, make favorable commercial loans, and they effectively destroyed their institutions and destroyed those other institutions that were associated with them. The last class of institutions that are subject to this are the new non-bank banks, those national banks that have been recently chartered, would like to be able to take now accounts and make full commercial loans. And they had full notice about the board's proposed regulations, a very recent development. They, too, could conform their activities by giving up the now accounts. And so that as far as some great revolution is concerned in the banking industry, that there is no such great revolution. What the board's regulation does is effectively preserve the industry the way Congress intended it would be with the separation. What would happen is that there would be massive evasions of this basic congressional intention, which goes way back in our history, this emphasis on avoiding the combination of banking and commerce goes way back in our history. And if we did not have that, I think we would have a very great and major change. Another argument that is made is somehow that the board's regulation steps upon the jurisdiction of other federal banking agencies. And that, again, is simply not true. The board's regulation only regulates the owners of banks. It does not in any way regulate banks or industrial banks in any way.
Well, certainly other agencies have expressed disagreement with the board's regulation, have they not?
There are some who have expressed disagreement. For example, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board expresses a specific agreement with the regulation, and there's a letter attached to our reply brief from the Home Loan Bank Board indicating that. Another of the bank regulatory agencies disagrees with us as a policy matter, but it doesn't disagree with us as a matter of law. There are numerous, for example, the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, in a group that represents all of the banking regulators in the states, they have filed an amicus brief in this case which fully supports the board's
position.
Well,
I wasn't thinking so much of a poll of all the affected parties as the fact that perhaps other federal agencies disagree might suggest that your construction of federal law might be mistaken in a way that it wouldn't be if they didn't disagree with you.
I didn't mean a poll, Your Honor, either. I was pointing out that certainly there isn't unanimity, but the board is the expert in this area. The Congress deliberately gave to the board. It had other choices as to organizing the Bank Holding Company Act, organizing administration of the Bank Holding Company Act. But the Congress specifically gave this to the board, and the board has the expertise in this area. The board carefully considered all of these comments from the other agencies, from private parties, and after a formal rule, an informal rulemaking, carefully considered this and in a more than 40-page opinion, analyzed all these comments, and in a reasoned opinion came to the conclusion that this regulation is necessary in order to carry out the purposes of the Act and prevent evasions of the Act, both powers which Congress has given to the board.
Mr. Bradfield, Justice Rehnquist emphasized the word legal right in dealing with deposits, and I was also interested in your comments on the second statutory requirement, and particularly the word making, in the business of making commercial loans. Are you going to address yourself to that? Seems to me that your regulation expands that concept rather dramatically.
Let me start by saying that the statute uses a very general term, commercial loans, making commercial loans. And clearly, if you're a business and you are in the business of, accepting commercial paper against your deposits, why, that is certainly a commercial loan. If you do it once a week or you do it twice a week, it is certainly in the business. I don't have any question. I don't think the board had any question that an institution that engages in those practices was in the business of making commercial loans. Now, I imagine if there could be such a circumstances where you did one such transaction a year, and I think then your point would be well taken. But I don't think that this was addressed to that. This was addressed to the situation where an institution regularly, and I think that that's what's necessary for a depository institution, it regularly engages in this kind of activity. Commercial paper, bankers' acceptances, CDs, those are all loans from one business to another. I would also point out that this is a very important point, that in adopting that commercial loan test, the Congress thought it was exempting a single trust company. It didn't know anything about its activities other than that which that entity represented to the Congress, and that was that it was a fiduciary institution, a trust company, and primarily engaged in fiduciary activities. And the House conferees, in their manager's report, said specifically that provision should be narrowly construed, as well as other specific exemptions that were then, like, for example, the grandfather clause. That clause and this clause on commercial lending, there was a specific injunction exception, the commercial lending exception, be narrowly construed. There's specific statutory language, not statutory, specific legislative history that covers that. I'd like to emphasize that the board has the independence of judgment and a broad perspective gained from its responsibilities for monetary policy and for the regulation of the banking industry. It's the country's central bank. It regulates the money supply. It's the lender of last resort, the regulator of the payment system, and a regulator of over 1,000 member banks. The point is that these broad responsibilities give the board a perspective and a special expertise in administering the act. The board used this expertise in the case before you. It engaged in detailed rulemaking. It carefully analyzed the facts and articulated the reasons for its conclusions, and in a comprehensive and thoroughly reasoned opinion, concluded that those definitions are necessary to carry out the Act's purposes of separating banking from commerce. This is clearly a case in which the doctrine of administrative deference is applicable. Mr. Chief Justice, with your permission, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Bradfield, the question here is, of course, not what is the sensible and sound thing to do. We could concede that the board has come to very sensible conclusions. The question is more narrowly whether whether the board can construe the statute that way.
Well, if I may just offer as the reasons for that conclusion, Mr. Chief Justice, is one that the board's definition fit the literal language of the Act. A now account is an instrument that is payable on demand. The statute doesn't say notice, and so that it is an instrument that is payable on demand. The instruments that the board defined as commercial loans are commercial loans. It's a broad term, and the board clearly has the discretion to give that term meaning. There is no rigid industry definition. It's the board that is responsible for giving that term definition. And the third point is that the board has broad power The statute specifically said the board is charged with administering the act, carrying out its purposes, and preventing evasions. Now, that we're not asking in this case, saying that that is the sole authority. We fit within the legislative language. The legislative history indicates that those two provisions were intended to be narrowly construed. You combine those two elements, narrow construction and literal language, together with the broad authority of the board to prevent evasions. And this Court has held that where that kind of broad authority, and it isn't usually given, where you have that kind of broad authority, then in that case you can even go beyond in Mourning versus the Family Publications. This Court said you could even go beyond the literal coverage of the statute in order to accomplish an objective to carry out the purposes of the underlying objective of the statutory purpose. Now, when you have those three elements, I think you clearly, and you have an expert agency, it's clearly a matter for to give deference to an administrative agency. Thank you.
Mr. Davidson.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I represent the group of petitioners whose primary concern is with the commercial loan aspect of the Board's new definition of bank in Regulation Y. Counsel who will speak after me represents the group of petitioners who is primarily concerned with the demand part of that definition. With respect to the commercial loan aspect of the definition, I wanted to discuss two points with the Court this afternoon. First, that the Board's new regulation seeks to expand the Bank Holding Company Act beyond the entire area of business that Congress intended to regulate with that statute. And second, that the Board's new definition of commercial loan is contrary to common usage and to congressional intent, and therefore cannot be justified on the grounds of agency deference or its evasion authority. On the first point, the language of the statute and its legislative history, and I think just as indicated by counsel for the board, shows that the Bank Holding Company Act is a statute designed for the regulation of the business of commercial banking. It does so by authorizing the board to regulate companies which own or control subsidiaries that are commercial banks. Now, commercial banks are institutions which accept deposits which commercial enterprises are eligible to maintain, in other words, corporate checking accounts, and which engage in the business of lending those deposits back to businesses in the form of commercial loans. The board's brief to this court have stressed the importance of both aspects of those defining characteristics of the business of commercial banking. In the board's original brief, the board has pointed out that corporate checking accounts typically constitute a very substantial proportion of the total demand aspect, demand deposits of a commercial bank. And in the board's reply brief, the board argues that the foremost obligation of a commercial bank is to supply the credit needs of business enterprises in its community. Now, there are, and there always have been, other kinds of providers of financial services which are not engaged in the business of commercial banking, as that term is as indicated. Prominent among them are institutions that are more consumer-oriented, which are engaged in the business of providing financial services to individuals, including the service of consumer lending. Now, one key example is the whole category of industrial banks. And as the board brief itself notes, industrial banks historically are consumer-oriented institutions which serve industrial workers and similar customers who can't obtain credit from commercial banks. And there still is a need for such commercial banks today, and that's precisely such consumer banks today, and that is precisely why the controller found that the Dimension proposal, respondent Dimension Financial Corporation here before the court, to open consumer-oriented national banks not engaged in the business of commercial banking was warranted by the needs of the local communities where Dimension seeks to operate. In light of some of the comments which we have heard this afternoon, I think it is important to point out that these consumer banks, and for that matter their affiliates, are regulated to ensure their safety and soundness, some of them by the states, some of them, like the proposed Dimension banks, by federal agencies like the Controller of the Currency and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And there is no evidence that the existence of consumer banks or the fact that they are supervised under regulatory regimes apart from the particular one which is here at issue in this case, the Bank Holding Company Act, has ever posed a threat to the soundness of this nation's financial structure or the banking industry in general. That is the view of other government agencies, which have been expressed to this Court in this case, which are as equally concerned as the Board with the soundness of the nation's financial structure and banking system. That's the conclusion of a major empirical study published this year, performed by the staff of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. And I might note that the same arguments which the Board makes here in its briefs in an oral argument are the same arguments it has been making to Congress for the last few years. And Congress itself has not perceived the need for any particular emergency here and thought that it was necessary to expand the definition of bank under the Bank Holding Company Act in the manner in which the Board now seeks to accomplish through its regulation. In sum,
Congress is hardly a very weighty consideration with the courts.
I'm not suggesting that non-action by Congress is a mechanism by which to interpret the statutory language. What I am suggesting is that the Board's arguments to the Court that are basically there is something bad about to happen to the banking industry, there is some emergency situation here that compels the Board to step in and to expand the scope of its jurisdiction, is undercut by the fact that those same arguments have been made to Congress and that Congress has not seen fit to act to give the Board that authority. But when we turn to the specific issue of statutory construction, then I think we need to look at the language of the statute and the legislative history on what Congress has done, I would agree, as opposed to what Congress has not done. And I believe that the bank holding...
Well, Mr. Davidson, yes. Now the Board's new definition of commercial loan seems to boil down basically to saying that it covers any extension of credit between two parties where neither is a consumer. And that strikes me as perhaps consistent with the broad general term commercial loan, which Congress did not choose to define very specifically.
I think that the important point to think about in terms of the commercial loan language that Congress put into the statute with the 1970 amendment is that the commercial loan language at that time, the term commercial loan, is a phrase of common usage. It has a commonly understood meaning in the banking industry. And at that time, in 1970, when Congress put that phrase into the statute, and for that matter, to this day, the term commercial loan, as a matter of common usage, excludes money market and interbank transactions which financial institutions, including banks, use for day-to-day asset liability or liquidity management. The fact that money market and interbank transactions are distinct from what people commonly understand by the term commercial loan and indeed have different characteristics from commercial loans is something that has been demonstrated in a long string of Board decisions.
Well, how about some of these other items that are included in the definition?
The things that the Board has included in the definition of commercial loan, which we are challenging, is the money market and interbank transactions, commercial paper, bankers acceptances, broker call loans, purchase and sale of federal funds, and so forth. Those are instruments which banks use for day-to-day liquidity purposes and are not within the commonly understood meaning of the term commercial loan. That is something that the Board itself concluded over the course of many years in looking at those specific transactions and concluding that they were not within the meaning of the term commercial loan as intended by Congress when it put those terms into the statute. That's the real significance of the series of Board decisions. It also represents the views of other government agencies which have been expressed to this Court who are certainly familiar with banking transactions and banking terminology. It's also consistent with the comments of the Federal Reserve Banks. I realize that all that has been set forth before in our briefs. What I think I would like to add in the oral argument, however, is that same common usage, same common understanding runs right through the text cited by the Board in their reply brief. The Board in their reply brief cites as their prominent text that they rely on this book, Management Policies for Commercial Banks, the Cross and Hemphill text, to support their proposition, which they quote, they include the quotation, that loans to supply the credit needs of business enterprises in whatever form are commercial loans. Interesting, that quotation appears in a chapter in the book on bank lending, which begins with the chapter begins with actually the book drawing a sharp distinction between loans, bank loans, and other kinds of transactions that banks engage in for day-to-day liquidity purposes. It's a separate chapter of that book which discusses those kinds of transactions and how they are different and enumerates the instruments that banks use for day-to-day liquidity purposes as including federal funds, commercial paper, banker's acceptances, and negotiable CDs issued by other banks. As this book, as this text points out, and as all the prior decisions of even the board and its staff has pointed out, these kinds of transactions basically do not involve the same kind of borrower-lender relationship. And if one tracks through each of the three elements of commercial loans that Congress put into the statute in 1970, in other words, that it be a loan, that it be a loan to a commercial enterprise, and that it, the business be engaged in the business of the enterprise be engaged in the business of making the commercial loan, each one of these can be analyzed, and you can see why the term of these particular, why the nature of the particular money market or interbank transaction does not fall within what people have commonly understood to constitute a commercial loan. For those reasons, we believe that because the Congress inserted language into the statute which had common meaning at the time and which the board thought was self-executing.
Davis, can I just ask you one question? Supposing a bank does make a big loan to a manufacturer, $1 million loan, and then after it's partially paid off, the bank, another bank purchases that loan from the first bank. Has the second bank made a commercial loan?
Assumes the second loan. Sir, I believe that in, we have a situation where in one bank assumes the commercial loan entered by another, that that could very well be a commercial loan.
I realize it's a commercial loan. Has the second bank made a commercial loan, in your view?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe that that would be the situation of making a commercial loan unless one could indicate that there would be some transfer of funds from the second bank to the original borrower. In that case, which I suppose could happen in some situation where the loan would be refinanced or there would be some new relationship that would involve some face-to-face dealings and a negotiation of terms of the new loan assumption, you might be able to say that there was enough face-to-face relationship there to say that there was a making. But apart from that, I would suggest no. For those reasons and for the reasons stated in our brief, we believe that the board has exceeded the language of the statute and Congress's basic intent, not only with the commercial loan amendment in particular, but with the whole scope of what it seeks to regulate under the Bank Holding Company Act. And for those reasons, we believe that no amount of agency deference or deference to the agency's evasion authority can justify the board in doing something which is to expand its jurisdiction in a manner that Congress did not intend and indeed is contrary to specific limitations on that jurisdiction that Congress put into the statute when, for example, it amended the Act to include the commercial loan provision. And for those reasons, we would urge the Court to affirm the ruling of the Tenth Circuit. Thank you.
Mr. Hawk.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The issue that I wish to address is the validity of the Board's attempt in this case to expand its Bank Holding Company Act jurisdiction to cover industrial banks by the means of redefining a statutory term relating to so-called demand deposits. Industrial bank is the name that's given to a variety of small financial institutions chartered under state law, principally to provide installment credit to consumers and to small businesses. According to data recently submitted to Congress by the Federal Reserve, industrials currently operate in about 20 states. There are about 1,200 of them in the country in existence, and their total deposits are only about $5 billion. Industrials typically offer two types of deposit accounts, savings deposits and investment certificates. Virtually all states that authorize industrials prohibit them from offering true demand deposits, that is, deposits as to which the depositor has a legal right to withdraw on demand. 10 states, however, currently authorize industrials to permit withdrawals from savings accounts by negotiable instrument. Approximately 95 industrials, according to the board's information, offer so-called now accounts. Although I should say that it's a fair assumption that because of the cloud of uncertainty cast over this portion of their activities by the board's attempts to regulate industrials over the last few years, that there are many industrials who are waiting to see what the outcome of this litigation is on this issue. The American Financial Services Association and the other petitioners that I represent have challenged the board's efforts to bring industrials under bank holding company jurisdiction, not only because of their conviction that industrials were never intended by Congress to be covered under that act, because they are not by any stretch of the imagination commercial banks, but also because the board's new treatment of industrials confronts corporate owners of these institutions with the choice of either radically altering their own activities or causing the institutions to curtail their services to their customers in a way that would inevitably make them less useful and less competitive. I'd like to dwell just a bit longer on the board's earlier treatment of industrials, because I think the defect in their present position is clearly revealed by a reference to the history of the board's attempts in the past to cover industrials. As Mr. Bradfield said, in 1956, the sole test of bankness under the Bank Holding Company Act was whether an institution held a charter as a national bank or a state bank. In 1963, however, the Fed ruled that a state-chartered industrial loan company would be included under the definition of bank if it, and now I quote, accepts deposits subject to check or otherwise accepts funds from the public that are, in actual practice, repaid on demand, as are demand or savings deposits held by commercial banks, unquote. The actual practice language was a reference to the fact that savings accounts, both in industrials and in commercial banks, have historically been subject to a reserved right in the institution to require some period of notice before withdrawal, a right that is almost never exercised, even though its reservation is uniformly compelled by state and federal law. In 1965, the board reaffirmed its position, holding that industrials that offered investment certificates that were repaid in practice on demand were subject to the Bank Holding Company Act. And again, there was no attempt to distinguish industrials on the basis of whether they offered checking accounts. The industrials took their case to Congress, and in 1966, Congress responded by repudiating the board's attempt to extend its jurisdiction over this type of financial institution. Congress fully recognized the difference between prior notice accounts, as to which the right of notice was required but almost never exercised, and true demand deposits, where no such right existed at all. And Congress amended the Bank Holding Company Act definition to include as banks only those institutions offering deposits that were withdrawable on demand as a matter of legal right. The board argued at that time for a definition that used the terminology demand deposit, but Congress rejected that and used the very technical, rather stilted language, deposits that the depositor has a legal right to withdraw on demand, and it used that language for the specific purpose of assuring that that deposits that were withdrawable as a matter of practice on demand would not be covered under the Act. Contrary to Mr. Bradfield's suggestion, the board definition that is in the present regulation would include passbook savings accounts, and this Justice O'Connor asked if it would, if the withdrawal from the savings account was made by check. A now account is really no more than an interest-bearing savings account from which withdrawals may be made by a variety of methods, either by the presentation of a passbook or a withdrawal slip or by a negotiable instrument. So a now account is nothing but an interest-bearing savings account, and it's distinguishable from a true demand deposit in several distinct and important respects. First of all and foremost, now accounts are not available to business customers. They're only available to individuals. Second, now accounts may bear interest. True demand deposits may not. The non-interest-bearing account that is available to businesses, that is the classic demand deposit account, is what Congress chose as the hallmark of a commercial bank. Commercial banks still issue that kind of account. Industrial banks do not and cannot. The board now tries to reassert its jurisdiction over industrials by making two arguments. First, they argue that the depositors do, in fact, have a legal right to withdraw on demand until the institution actually exercises its right to require prior notice of withdrawal. And second, they argue that the legal right to withdraw on demand language really doesn't mean what it says, but it was intended to apply to checking accounts. And I don't think there's any merit in either one of those arguments. The first argument simply amounts to playing with words, and it ignores the plain meaning of the statute. What Congress clearly meant to do by using the phraseology legal right to withdraw on demand was to exclude prior notice accounts, fully recognizing that the prior notice was almost never exercised. The Board's argument flies in the face of the legislative history, and it would make nonsense of what Congress intended to do in 1966. The argument also flies in, face of the, in the face of the Board's own longstanding interpretation of the distinction between demand deposits and savings deposits. The Board has been aware for decades that the reserved right of notice is almost never exercised with respect to interest-bearing savings accounts that are in practice withdrawn on demand. Yet that distinction, as slim as it may appear, has always sufficed in Board regulations. Indeed, it suffices today to distinguish such accounts from demand deposits on which a payment of interest is prohibited. The second argument, that the language should be read to mean checking accounts rather than what it says, is simply wishful thinking. Congress did not, in 1966 or at any time thereafter, define banks in terms of the means by which deposits could be withdrawn. It defined them in terms of depositors' legal rights. And particularly in the context of this case, it used that definition to distinguish industrial banks from commercial banks. If Congress had really intended the method of withdrawal to distinguish between commercial banks and industrial banks, it would have been very easy for it to do so by defining that leg of the definition of bank in terms of checking accounts rather than accounts that the depositor had a legal right to withdraw on demand. More important, the Fed's expansive interpretations of 1963 and 1965 that led Congress to amend the Act to ensure that industrials would not be covered were not keyed simply to the means of withdrawal. They were based on the fact that deposits nominally subject to a right of notice were in practice paid on demand. And the legislative history is absolutely clear that Congress did not consider industrials to present the same considerations as conventional commercial banks. The intention of Congress in amending the definition of a bank was to exclude industrial banks from Fed jurisdiction, not to describe a particular means of withdrawal. The fact was then, as it is now, that industrials do not and cannot issue deposit accounts from which a depositor has an unquenchable legal right to withdraw on demand. And unlike commercial banks, they can't issue checking accounts to businesses that can be used for commercial purposes. Their accounts are limited to consumer accounts. In conclusion, we believe that the history of the Board's effort to assert jurisdiction over this segment of the financial services industry makes this a particularly compelling case to leave to the Congress. Since almost 20 years ago, Congress tried to make clear to the Board that industrials were not to be covered under the Bank Holding Company Act, and if the Board now believes that industrials have so changed in the nature of the services that they offer, a proposition that we vigorously dispute, it should be required to make that case to Congress, and it shouldn't be permitted to use the kind of jurisdictional self-help that it's tried to use here, with the consequence of upsetting years of settled doctrine and creating unjustifiably turmoil in this segment of the financial services industry. Thank you.
You have 5 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I would like to start by pointing out that the basic approach that Congress has had to this whole question of bank holding company activities is that the combination of ownership by industrial and commercial firms of banks is just too fraught with the potential for abuse to be permitted. The alternative of permitting such combinations but subjecting them to careful regulations was rejected, was considered, and it was rejected by the Congress. It had decided instead that only a complete divorce is workable. Overturning the Board's rule would permit this incompatible marriage to take place contrary to the intention of Congress. So rather than the Board extending its jurisdiction, the Board is simply implementing what Congress already intended in 1956 and 1966 and in 1970. If you take that approach and then you look at the respondents' representations that they are just small consumer organizations,
And you have to ask yourself the question whether the industrial banks and Dimension are small consumer organizations, and you have to ask yourself the question. They may be today, but will they be tomorrow? If they have this authority to combine NOW accounts and commercial loans, full commercial loans, won't they be able to use this authority in a way, precisely the way that Congress said it shouldn't be used? NOW accounts, I should remind you, are a very major portion of our money supply. There's over $171 billion in NOW accounts, larger than currency in circulation and almost as large, 65% of the amount of demand deposits. NOW accounts are money, and that's what Congress wanted to regulate. The respondents suggest that nothing bad is going to happen as a result of allowing this trend to continue. Congress knew that that was possible. They considered that, and I can only cite to you exactly what happened in Maryland and Ohio as examples of what bad things can happen and how the system can be destabilized by this kind of development. I'd like to also point out that the charge has been made that there is a common usage with respect to commercial loan. I don't think that the court should be confused by the term money market instrument, as if there's some kind of independent market in which buyers and sellers congregate and there are independent transactions. Justice Stevens was exactly correct that if a commercial bank buys a loan from another commercial bank, it has made a commercial loan, and if there's a problem with that loan, it is responsible and has to engage in direct face-to-face negotiations with the other party in order to straighten things out. Similarly, broker call loans are direct face-to-face negotiations. Certainly most commercial paper, more than 50 to 60%, more than half of commercial paper is directly negotiated between the borrower and the lender. There's a suggestion that the Congress intended to repudiate the board and the board's definitions when the board initially covered industrial banks in 1963. Well, that's hardly a conclusion that you can draw from the record. In 1958, the board made 20 recommendations on the Bank Holding Company Act and how the Bank Holding Company Act should be improved. The Congress adopted every one except one, which was a minor provision of not great significance. I would finally point out that the notice requirement that the respondents on NOW accounts, the notice requirement that they propose is just sufficient to take an instrument, the NOW account, from outside the bank holding company. If there's notice, it's enough. If that were true, any bank holding company, the largest bank holding company, could simply put a notice on its accounts and simply escape from the Bank Holding Company Act. That was considered in the Fifth Circuit decision, and it was that kind of situation was said. That's an evasion of the Act, and it should be an evasion of the Act here as well. Finally, I'd like to point out that while these respondents claim to be small and of not great significance in doing great public good, I would like to point out that on page 1A of the appendix is a list thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.